I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump's demand that Mexico pay for the border wall has led to a Twitter feud and the threat of a trade war. Yesterday, Mexican President Peña Nieto canceled his trip to Washington planned for next week. Also yesterday, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer told reporters that a 20% import tax would cover the cost of the wall, then had to walk that back, saying it was just one idea under consideration. President Trump spoke to Republicans on Thursday meeting here in Philadelphia, saying this will be the busiest Congress ever. British Prime Minister Theresa May also spoke to Republicans yesterday in Philadelphia about the special relationship between the two countries. She is meeting with President Trump today to talk about trade. She's also in the process of implementing Britain's withdrawal from the EU. The election of Trump, Brexit, the rise of politicians like Francis Marine Le Pen are just a few examples of the growing popularity of populist and nationalist movements. Well, here to talk about all of this and a lot to talk about is Edward Alden. He's the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a new book called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And Edward Alden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Emily Tamkin, staff writer for Foreign Policy. And Emily Tamkin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here.
Emily, let me begin with you. But Ted, I want to have you jump in as well. I guess now we carry out foreign policy on 140 characters or less. So who canceled first? Do we know the answer to that, Emily? This is about the Mexican president's canceled visit to the U.S.
If one believes the Mexican administration, they canceled. If one believes White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, it was mutual. I will sort of leave it to listeners to interpret or decide for themselves which is the correct answer.
Ted, do you think this is a diplomatic crisis between the U.S. and Mexico?
Oh yes. No, I think it's quite a serious one. I think this is the worst rift in U.S.-Mexican relations that we have seen in many decades. Certainly may be possible to repair, but to have Mexico's president cancel the first planned visit to meet with the new president in the United States, that's an extraordinary gesture and indicates what a difficult situation has been created in the first week of the Trump administration.
I do want to talk about that, but I don't even know if I know the answer to this, but Emily, I'll toss it to you. I mean, it is interesting that the Mexican president invited Donald Trump to come to Mexico while he was campaigning and certainly using the wall as this rallying cry. And now that Donald Trump is president and he's talking about building the wall, the Mexican president cancels. Can you explain? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. What's even more interesting to me is that the person who organized that visit was, and I don't speak Spanish, so apologies for my accent, but was Luis Videgaray, who at the time was finance minister and now is foreign minister, who was in Washington the same day that Trump signed this executive order. You know, I think we can say Trump was clear throughout the entire campaign that he intended to build this wall, but Mexico was also clear throughout the entire campaign that they were not going to pay for the wall, even with the visit by Trump to Mexico. So, you know, I think that that Mexico was also quite clear on this. I think it's also important to remember that after Trump made that visit to Mexico, there was some frustration and disappointment on the part of the Mexican people. Videgaray actually resigned from his position. Peña Nieto currently has an approval rating of about 12%.
Whoa.
So I think that it was also it would not have been politically expedient for him to make this visit after the day that his foreign minister is in Washington, Trump signed an executive order on this border wall without telling the Mexican government first.
Now, Ted, it seemed to be coming from the Trump administration and I think from some Republicans as well that if there was a 20% import tax, that would, in a sense, be the way that the U.S. would make Mexico pay for the border. Did that backfire? And is that true?
Well, I don't think there's any question it backfired when the press secretary Sean Spicer said it. You know, reporters obviously picked up the phone and began talking to trade experts. And what trade experts told them was, wait, a tariff isn't paid by Mexican companies or the Mexican government. It's paid by the American companies that are importing products from Mexico. And then they pass those costs on to the consumers. So, you know, basically Trump's new slogan would have to be make American guacamole lovers pay for the wall. So it was really a ridiculous proposal in terms of suggesting that this would be a mechanism to force Mexico to pay for the wall. And as you saw, Sean Spicer seemed to be walking it back pretty quickly. There is a larger issue that he hinted at, which has to do with the nature of a big corporate tax reform bill that the Republicans are considering. We can talk about that if you want, but clearly as a sort of strategy amidst the chaos of yesterday, it definitely backfired on the administration.
Ted, just a quick follow-up there. If that were to go, if the U.S. was going to go ahead on this import tax, would that violate NAFTA? Do we know?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I mean, an across-the-board 20% import tax would violate rules under both NAFTA and under the World Trade Organization. The problem in both cases is that the dispute resolution provisions under trade agreements are very slow. It could take, months, even years for these cases to work their way through. So a lot of damage could be done before the United States found itself on the losing end of any decision.
Well, let's talk a bit about Theresa May. I'm sure we'll come back to Mexico and NAFTA, but the Prime Minister of Britain was here in Philadelphia yesterday. She was speaking to Republicans who were in the city for a retreat, and I thought it was just sort of an odd place, Emily Tamkin, to have a foreign leader speak to a partisan group. Did anything strike you strange about that?
That was sort of odd, in particular because she didn't also meet with the Democrats, who, granted or not, don't sort of have power right now, but apparently Democrats were quite upset by this. But what struck me listening to the speech, and what just strikes me as so interesting about Theresa May, is that she doesn't really have Trump's same ideology. So if you listen to what she said in Philadelphia, she spoke about the importance of NATO. Right. She spoke about the importance of being wary with Russia, of Russia. She spoke sort of against protectionism, or has at various points in her career. And I think it's important to remember that Theresa May did not back Brexit, right? Theresa May wanted Britain to remain in the European Union and is sort of carrying out this will of the people that she herself does not have, and so needs to sort of try to get a trade deal with Trump for some time in the future after this reality that she doesn't want is implemented.
Well, Ted, there is this special relationship between the U.S. and Britain. I'm sure sometimes it's more special than others. Who do you think is in the driver's seat when it comes to this relationship, especially with these two new leaders?
Well, it's interesting. I would say neither of them. They're kind of stuck in what I think will be a slightly dysfunctional marriage that neither wants to walk away from. I mean, for President Trump, he needs to be able to show that he is not all about building walls and putting up tariffs. He needs to show that he's got some sort of positive agenda. So being able to talk about negotiating a bilateral trade agreement with the UK is politically important for Donald Trump. Similarly, Theresa May is trying to buy bargaining leverage with the European Union. She's in the process. She's been pretty clear what her strategy is. She's going to notify within the next couple of months Britain's intention to leave the European Union, and that is going to mean that there are new barriers to Britain's exports to its largest customers, which are in Europe. She needs to have a plan B, and being able to say to the British people, we're going to do this wonderful trade deal with the United States, which will open up new opportunities for British companies and offset the losses in Europe, that's very important for her. But I think on a lot of issues, the two will not see eye to eye. So I think it's going to be a more difficult relationship than it appears right at the moment.
Well, it even seems I was listening to her speech as well yesterday, stylistically, language, message. I mean, a very, I would say, Emily Tamkin, very un-Trumpian way of speaking compared to the way our president speaks.
Oh, stylistically, just the polar opposite of Trump. And I also want to note that she, this idea. Let me back up. When she gave her speech, sort of outlining what Brexit meant, before that she had sort of said Brexit means Brexit. She gave the speech. She made clear that Brexit would not mean trying to remain in the single EU market. They were going to take a more global approach and make trade deals outside of the EU, including the United States. Fine. The reality now is that she's more in some ways dependent on the United States than before. So, for example, there are reports that have come out that perhaps they would open the National Health Services to American firms, which will not go down well with the British voter, given different standards between in the United States versus in the United Kingdom. So it's this if Brexit was about taking back control, it would seem that Theresa May, again, who now has to meet with the president who comports himself very differently than she does, Theresa May now sort of has to relinquish some control to this other head of state.
You mentioned standards, Emily. Would it also mean lowering standards on things like food? I know that a lot of countries in Europe do not like GMOs, something that we export. Is that an issue?
Based on what I have read and what I have seen, yes, that could come into – because they need to show that they're still a global trading partner, right? And so – and part of that means making this deal with the United States, which again has very different standards for food than Britain currently does.
To you, Ted, so as we understand what President Trump's policy is, it's about making America great again. It's about buying American. It's about hiring Americans. How do you have trade deals if that's our policy?
Yeah, it's a fundamental contradiction, because trade deals are premised on the notion of mutual benefits. And one of the core principles of any trade deal, be it a bilateral trade deal or a broader multilateral trade deal, is you do not discriminate on the basis of nationality. So, if in the case of a UK, a U.S. trade deal, if a British company makes a product better and cheaper, then we should be buying that product rather than equivalent product from an American company. Trump doesn't like that. Trump has made it very clear he's in favor of Buy America. When he revived the Keystone pipeline this week, he said he wants to see the pipeline made all from American steel. Those kinds of statements are fundamentally at odds with the way trade agreements are supposed to work. Now, in theory, in any of these agreements, you can do carve-outs, and you could do an agreement in which the United States insisted on expanding Buy America provisions for certain products, but then British in turn would do the same thing, and it would reduce the benefits from the agreement. So there are a lot of contradictions in Trump's approach, again, that we will see play out in the coming months and years.
Almost up in a break here, but Ted, is it that he's got two messages, one for his voters, his supporters, and one for, what, economists or the Republican Party or all the other stakeholders?
Well, I think by and large, he doesn't have his trade people confirmed yet. He's operating with a small staff in the White House. I think to a considerable extent, Trump does not understand the constraints under which the United States operates. And, of course, his theory of leadership is that he can blow through all the rules and constraints. But the reality is the United States has made commitments. There are ways in which these trade agreements are done. He can certainly tweak that at the margins, but you can't fundamentally, turn a cow into a goat. And I think that's what he's trying to do.
Turn a cow into a goat. That's Edward Alden joining us, along with Emily Tamkin, talking about a whole host of things: trade deals, U.S.-Mexico relations, U.S. Relations with Great Britain. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Emily Tamkin, staff writer for Foreign Policy, and Edward Alden. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a book called Failure to Adjust: How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And we've been talking about Brexit, U.S. relations with Mexico, and we will be talking more about the populism that's sweeping the world, examining some of the root causes of this new movement. In the meantime, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Emily, let me go back to you. And Theresa May was not a supporter of Brexit, but as Prime Minister, she needs to carry out what the voters want. What is the process, I guess, of Britain withdrawing from the EU, and where does it stand today?
Recently been further complicated because the Supreme Court over there, Supreme Court British edition, decided that or ruled that only Parliament could trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Agreement, which is the mechanism by which Brexit negotiations will begin. So yesterday, Theresa May or Theresa May's government put forth a bill before Parliament. It's only 137 words long. It's two sentences that basically says that we can go ahead and do this. They're trying to have that passed by both houses of Parliament in the coming weeks so that Theresa May can keep her promise of having Article 50 triggered by March 31st. After that, negotiations with the EU will begin and could take, years.
Take like several years, 10 years?
Right. What, yes. So not years. Probably several years. Her – the there was some infighting with her ministers in that the British ambassador to the EU ended up resigning saying this is going to take 10 years. This is – this is a mess. You haven't thought through what this is going to be. I think that with their declaration that they will not be remaining in the single market, that sort of might clear some of that up, right, because they're – negotiating from a different position, but it will not be a quick and clean process to remove Britain from the European Union.
Ted, do you want to weigh in on this about the process of Britain removing itself from the EU?
Yeah, I mean, just a slight clarification. So under the Article 50 notification procedures, which Theresa May's government has said they're going to invoke before the end of March, that puts in place a two-year clock on the negotiations. Now, I mean, in theory, if there were agreement between the UK and the EU, those negotiations could be extended. But I think that there is determination both by the British and by the European Union to try to resolve their issues in 2 years, to lift some of the uncertainty that exists now for businesses operating in the UK and in the European Union. But this is clearly going to be an extraordinarily difficult negotiation. Most of the rules under which businesses currently operate in Britain are European Union rules. The procedures for resolving commercial disputes are fought out through the European Court of Justice. Britain wants to extricate itself from all of that, and it's going to be hugely difficult to do that without doing a lot of damage to British companies and to foreign companies that have invested in the UK.
And where is the UK party today? I mean, the party that was really behind Brexit. Emily, I believe Nigel Farage has a radio show now, and Boris Johnson is a diplomat someplace. Is what's left of the people in the party that wanted Brexit so badly?
Yes. So Farage, after the referendum passed, stepped down because he said he wanted his life back. He sort of for temporarily stepped back up, but he is now over here as a Fox commentator. Boris Johnson, who, as you said, also backed Brexit, is now foreign minister. The head of UKIP is currently a gentleman by the name of Paul Nuttall, who has when the Supreme Court made its ruling, said very dramatically, woe betide any politician who stands in the way of the people's vote. So UKIP is still a force in British politics, I think, now mostly to sort of make sure that this goes through. But they're still, the person who for years and years put it all in motion, Nigel Farage, is not actually seeing that motion carried out.
Ted, do you see Brexit and even the election of Donald Trump, and I do want to talk about some other leaders as well, do you see this as a populist movement that's sweeping parts of the world?
Well, I think pretty clearly. I don't know whether populism is the right term or not, but I think we are seeing a fundamental ideological realignment taking place in much of the developed world. I mean, if you look really going back at least to Reagan-Thatcher days, the central split between conservatives and liberals has been over the role of government. How much should government be doing? Should government be getting out of the market, or should government be doing more to help people who are harmed by market forces? Those have been the big debates for the last 30 years. I think now we are moving into a new divide, which is between nationalists on one side and internationalists on the other side, those who believe that their countries do better when they're enmeshed in these networks of global rules and norms, and those who believe that nation states need to seize back the sovereignty that has been ceded. And it's a very different sort of politics. I find myself kind of whiplashed watching someone like Speaker Paul Ryan seemed to support Trump on issues like trade protectionism and immigration restrictions. I mean, the core of the Republican Party for many years has been free trade and free movement of people. Those were core parts mm-hmm. of Ronald Reagan's beliefs. So we are seeing a rather dramatic ideological realignment taking place, not just in the United States, but we can talk more about Europe, too. But same things are going on there.
But let me just follow up with you, Ted. But I'm thinking about some of the parallels, I guess, that we hear and see. Surely concerns about the loss of jobs, migration, refugees, maybe even the fallout of the recession. The changing world that I think that we're all living in. Do you think these are some of the features of this nationalism or this populism?
Yes, absolutely. And it's really a lot of what I wrote about in my book. I think, you know, the issue here is loss of control. I mean, what leaders have been saying to their peoples for years is, look, these things are good for you. Free trade is good for you. Open immigration is good for you. If you happen to be in a group that's harmed by that, you know, say a steel worker who loses his or her job to Chinese imports, or computer programmer at Disney who loses his or her job because Indians are willing to do the same work for cheaper. You know, you've basically been told, get with the program. This is the way the world works. And I think what you're seeing is a real backlash against that. People are saying, we want governments to play a more active role in protecting, in insulating us from global market forces, whether it be trade or immigration. And you have new leaders, most prominently among them Donald Trump, stepping up to take on that role. I mean, Trump's inaugural speech was like nothing we have ever seen for years and years and years in the United States. He basically said, I am a protectionist, and protection will make America stronger. This is not Ronald Reagan's Republican Party anymore.
I mean, it's kind of a strange nostalgia. Emily, you want to weigh in on that at all about what you see in the rise of nationalism / populism?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think it's important to note that while we're certainly seeing a shift toward the prominence of this in Europe today, in Europe, this is not new. You know, Nigel Farage has been in and out of UK politics for, I think, 20 years? AfD, the far-right party in Germany, has been around since 2013. Marine Le Pen, between her and her father, it's been decades yep. for the National Front in France, right? But this has been there. It's been in the air, and I think the sort of storm clouds are gathering now, if you will. I think I completely agree that if trade and globalization are making life better for almost everyone, but not for you personally, right, then you as a voter will feel left behind and sort of throw your weight behind these parties. But I sort of don't want to skip over the fact that a lot of these parties have, as part of their platform, for example, Alternative for Deutschland has mm-hmm. as part of its platform that Islam has no place in Germany. That's not just anti-trade, right? That's explicitly Islamophobic. And I think, Zadie Smith wrote this piece called On Fences, Brexit, after the Brexit vote. And she said that while there is this, while so much of it is economic anxiety, it also kicked up a lot of casual racism. And I think that you see that on both sides of the Atlantic when we're talking about populism and nationalism in a way that you don't necessarily need to if it's just based on economic anxiety.
And I do want to pick up on that. That's Emily Tamkin, staff writer for Foreign Policy. Also with us, Edward Alden, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a new book called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. We are talking about the global economy, trade deals, U.S. relationship with Mexico and with Great Britain, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ted, let me go back to you and talk a bit about Marine Le Pen, head of the right-wing National Front, apparently, from what I read in preparation for the show today, making some inroads in France to be their upcoming president. First vote is in a couple of months. Is she sort of a less racist and incendiary? Is she kind of a kinder, gentler National Front representative?
Maybe at the margins, kinder and gentler than her father, who was a Holocaust denier. But she clearly, is playing very much into this whole set of you know, highly nationalistic themes, France for the French. It's got economic overtones, and I think I agree with Emily. It's certainly got, you know, racial and ethnic overtones as well. It'll be very interesting to watch the French election. I feel like we're in a little bit of a situation like we were here in the United States last summer, thinking, okay, well, we've got the rise of this strong nationalist candidate, but at the end of the day, the public will probably opt for a safer alternative. That safer alternative exists in France. François Fillon, the conservative candidate who is likely to end up in the final runoff against Marine Le Pen. The polls seem to suggest that he is more popular than she is. He's trying to move in a more nationalist direction and take away some of her appeal. But this will be a big vote, not just for France, but for the world.
There apparently was a conference in Germany of like-minded people. Marine Le Pen was there. And the quote that I saw was something she said: 2016 was the year the Anglo-Saxon world woke up. Speaking to what you just said there, Ted, it seems like there are some racist, xenophobic implications in that phrase or that sentence.
I mean, I think there are, and I will, you know, I will admit to a bias on these things because I tend to focus on the economics. I don't doubt that people in Europe, people in the United States, are made uncomfortable by higher levels of immigration that bring in people who don't look like they do and don't speak the same language. But I do think economics has a lot to do with this. You know, if you look at the European states, these are all strong welfare states with fairly high tax rates that give a great deal of benefits to their people. You lose a job in Germany or in Denmark, the government does a lot to help you out. Sweden, another good example of this. When you're running that sort of society, the question of who is us really matters a great deal. You can't simply let everyone in because you simply couldn't afford to operate a state on that basis if the doors are wide open. So I think these are very, very difficult issues for states to resolve. You know, what are our obligations to the rest of the world? There was, you know, a lot of praise for Angela Merkel for taking in so many Syrian refugees. And I have to say, on a personal level, I admire it. But I think politically, that was probably a mistake. That was more than the German people were really prepared to accept and deal with. And I think if mainstream political leaders want to hold on to power, they're going to have to make these tougher calculations about what their people are ready to support.
Let me get Linda from Princeton to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Linda? Linda joining us from Princeton. Go ahead, Linda. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty. Morning. I'll try to make this a concise question.
That would be
my
great.
My brain is scrambled at the moment.
Yeah, make it concise.
I'd like to ask your guests, given the stoking of racial fear, Islamophobia, isolationism, et cetera, on the part of Mr. Trump, both before the election and now, there are many economic policies he's not going to be able to carry out, which his base wants him to carry out. Do you believe it's possibly stoking all of these fears about the other, in order to cover and still keep that base and just say, well, we couldn't have done anything because these people are destroying our country. I did my best, because he's not going to be able to deliver on those economic policies for his base.
Well, Lynn, I don't know if we can get inside the mind of Donald Trump, but let me give Emily Tamkin just a chance to take a whack at that. What do you think, Emily?
What I think is I'm also not going to try to read Donald Trump's mind, but what I do think is really interesting is that many a man and woman smarter than myself has said that Trump's policies, if enacted, his economic policies, would not benefit some of his core voting base. And I think, you know, going back to what we were just saying about economic versus sort of social fears in Europe, Marine Le Pen's latest plan was, I believe, to have sort of two currencies. So to have a return to the franc for within France, but then to stay in some sort of eurozone when dealing with which doesn't seem to make a lot of economic sense, right? So I do think that there's this tension between, okay, this person is promising to deliver me economically. Am I going to unpack what that would actually mean for me, or if these economic promises could even be carried out? Maybe not, because I feel like somebody is finally speaking to me. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But, Ted, You have to be people with PhDs to understand how trade policies work. And I mean, this is complicated stuff for anyone to try to understand and digest.
Yeah, they, I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, I do think the caller has a point, because if you look at the policies the Trump administration and the congressional Republicans are talking about, they're not going to help a lot of the people who voted for him. You know, if they repeal and replace Obamacare, well, who have been the big beneficiaries of Obamacare? It's been the expansion of Medicaid for the poor, mostly in Republican states. So it's actually Trump voters who are going to be hurt if the Republicans go through with the health care plans that they're talking about. Tax reform, similarly, all of Trump's proposals will benefit those at the top and harm those lower down the income scale. But, you know, these are hard things for people to understand. And you know, certainly for anyone who saw the movie Wag the Dog.
Yeah, I do remember
Wag
that.
Wag the Dog, you know, I mean, foreign diversions and naming the enemy abroad, those can be very effective tactics for a political leader to try to divert attention from what's actually going on at home.
And we're almost having a break here, but Ted, I mean, any of these policies, it takes time before they get implemented and then the effect is felt. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, what we've seen this week is that the things that go after foreign countries are almost entirely under the control of the president. So, you know, he's pulled the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement with Asia. He's announced a whole new series of immigration restriction measures. He's going to roll out today a new set of measures to halt refugee flows and then scale them back dramatically. So all the things that in effect go after the foreigners are under the control of the president. The domestic policy pieces, tax reform or health care reform or education reform, those all have to go through the Congress and they take a long time.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Edward Alden and Emily Tamkin. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about populism. We are talking about Brexit, the fact that the Mexican president canceled his trip to meet with President Trump next week because of the wall. We're talking about trade policies, trade wars, and much more. 1-888-477-9499. That's the phone number to call in to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Here's a basic question from Anne. What's the difference between nationalism and populism? Emily, can you take a stab at that?
Sure, I can. I mean, the simple answer is that nationalism is in its sort of non. Actually, let me start with this.
Okay.
I don't think that there is necessarily anything far right or extremist about populism or nationalism. Populism being sort of what's good for the common person. Nationalism being pride in the nation state. I guess to just really simplify things.
Sure.
However, in their current manifestations, what you are seeing is populist and or nationalist extremism on the right and in certain places on the left as well, which tends to take on a sort of or can take on a violent jingoistic undertone.
I mean, Ted, it seems that going back a year that a lot of the supporters of Bernie Sanders and some of the supporters for Donald Trump probably would describe themselves as populist and probably would have or did share some populist ideas, trade being the most obvious example.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely accurate. I mean, I think at the end of the day, populism is essentially about returning power to the people. It's an anti-elite movement. It argues that, you know, that there are people at the upper reaches of finance or government or business that have seized control of the government and are using it in ways that are harmful to ordinary people. You know, the Davos Club being the sort of best example of it in the modern world. And populism is about taking that power back. It's not inherently either left-wing or right-wing. It can be either. And you see anti-elite movements coming from both the left and the right. That's why I say there has been a real ideological scrambling here. There are places where the Trump voters and the Sanders voters overlapped a lot. You know, if you look at the voting in union households this last election. You know, unions have historically supported the Democrats as the party of the working people, but a lot of union voters went for Donald Trump. So there's been a real, as I say, scrambling of the old categories.
Ted, I'm curious about whether and how then populist movements, not all of them, but some of them then become more dangerous, even in starting to embrace fascist ideas. Is there something that can flip that kind of a switch?
Well, I mean, I think partly you've got a situation where populists have to identify the adversary. You know, if someone is keeping the will of the people from being done, who are those people? And, you know, it's often shadowy elites of one sort or another. But, of course, as we saw in Nazi Germany, you know, the shadowy elites in the mind of the Nazi regime was, you know, the Jews, right, of Germany and Europe. And so, you know, you often, unfortunately, will see these populist movements descend into a kind of dangerous nationalism and authoritarianism. I'm not saying that that's going to happen this time around. I think lots of positive things can come out of populist movements, but there always is that danger when you have a movement that's based on identifying the enemy who's keeping the people's will from being done.
Let me read some emails from the people listening to our show. An email from Sharon: since Trump is so interested in wanting everything to be made in America, if it's sold in America, has anyone asked him or Sean Spicer when he's moving his manufacturing interest to the United States? Which I think is a good question. I don't believe it has been asked yet that I'm aware of. An email from Mark: during one of the debates with all the Republican candidates, Jeb Bush predicted that Trump is a chaos candidate and he will be a chaos president. This statement was prescient and proved true every day. A tweet from Ashok: I didn't realize that the UK really needed a deal with the US given Brexit. And let me pick up on that. And just to make sure I and our listeners understand, to you, Emily, does Britain have to leave Brexit before negotiating any or I guess signing any trade deals with the United States?
That is what Federica Mogherini, who is the Foreign Affairs Commissioner for the EU, made clear. So, yes, is the short answer. I'm sure that they can begin sort of talking about it in the abstract, but it is my understanding that ink cannot be dried on the proverbial page until they've put the exit in Brexit.
The exit in Brexit. Do you agree with that, Ted?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, currently, Brussels has trade negotiating authority for Britain. It doesn't actually have the independent ability to go out and negotiate trade agreements. So until that divorce is finalized, no deal with the United States can be concluded.
I was reading that Marine Le Pen admires Vladimir Putin. Clearly, Donald Trump admires Vladimir Putin. Ted, what is the appeal of Putin to some of these leaders?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it kind of gets back to the earlier question of you know, what is the appeal of a Trump-type figure? And I think, you know, the appeal is the argument that we've got a political system that is corrupted, that is unable to move forward, that is not carrying out the will of the people. And how do you deal with a corrupted system? Well, you need a strong leader, the strong leader who can cut through the gridlock, who can bring order and progress to the nation. And I think, you know, Trump sees in Putin, unfortunately, some of those strong leader elements. You know, there were ways in which, of course, Putin became the leader who pulled Russia out of the chaos of the breakup of the Soviet Union and the Yeltsin period and the oligarchs who took control of different sectors of the economy. I mean, Emily knows a lot about this. So
yes,
I
she does.
To her on it, but
I'll get to you, Emily. I promise. Go ahead, Ted.
There, so, yeah,
I know you're chomping at the bit there, Emily. No, I appreciate it. Go ahead and jump in because I know this is one of your areas of expertise.
Well, sure. Well, that's me. That's, no, what yeah, I would right. say is I would say two things. Firstly, I mean, yes, in a certain reading, Putin restored order to Russia after sort of the wild, wild west days of the 90s. There's a stability in Russia now that there was not then. Fine. He will also sort of have these these marathon phone sessions with people across the country and sort of, Vladimir Vladimirovich, when are we going to have a new playground? Oh, done. Look, I took care of the playground for that town somewhere in the middle of Russia. I get that appeal, right? And this idea that he presents as a very strong leader. Having said that, if your goal is to, one, empower the people, and two, pull corruption out of politics, you cannot in good conscience say that you should be emulating Vladimir Putin, number one. Number two, and I think this is less true for Trump and perhaps more true for Marine Le Pen and in particular this gentleman by the name of Norbert Hofer, who's in charge – who's the head of the Austrian Freedom Party, which was founded by former Nazis in 1955. They then go to Russia and take money to finance their campaigns. So if your goal is to have independence – for your country, you know, you want French independence for France, you want Austrian independence for Austria, it sort of is confusing to me that you can justify taking Russian money.
Is this a version of the Cold War, Emily? The return of a Cold or the Cold War?
You know, I personally, and I think there are plenty who disagree with me on this, I personally do not see returning to the Cold War as a useful paradigm. I think that a lot has changed between now and then. I also think that to say it's a return to the Cold War doesn't necessarily give enough credit or agency to the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. Mm. Having said that, polls – I mean, who can trust a poll these days? But polls show that sort of American opinions on Russians are – independent of Trump's feelings for Putin, are at an all-time low since the Soviet Union, I believe. So this sort of returned hostility, is there something Cold War-esque about that? Is there something Cold War-esque about sort of seeing Russia and the United States as adversaries? Sure.
I wonder, too, whether, Ted, whatever happens to Brexit, I mean, clearly Britain's in the process of removing itself from the EU. And who knows what will happen after that. But does that in any way empower Putin, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, any sort of weakness and disunity in Europe is something that Putin sees as in his interests. He's certainly, I think, tacitly and sometimes actively been encouraging the breakup of the European Union. I mean, again, I think what annoys him the most is the decision that was made by the United States and its allies in the aftermath of the Soviet breakup to push the NATO alliance right up to Russia's borders. And so I think he would particularly be interested in weakening the NATO alliance. So some of the noises that that President Trump made during the campaign about, well, we'll go to the aid of NATO allies only if they're meeting their defense spending obligations. Those are all things that very much play into Putin's interests, which seems to be expanding the scope of Russian authority, not necessarily recreating the old Soviet borders, but extending Russia's sphere of influence into the neighboring states. So yes, there's no doubt that Brexit helps Putin.
Emily, would you like to be a fly on the wall as Theresa May and Donald Trump meet today?
I would very much enjoy that. I am not sure how this meeting is going to go. I believe they're having a joint press conference after, so we can see whether or not she reenacts the great scene from Love Actually or not. I don't believe she will.
The great scene from what?
From Love Actually, which the Prime Minister stands up to the President. I don't really see that for her, but maybe.
I hadn't thought about that movie in a while. Tim, what do you anticipate will come out of this meeting today, if anything?
Oh, I think there'll be a lot of positive noises about the special relationship and the desire to do a trade deal going forward and the strong bond between the U.S. and Britain. I think that, you know, they will try to paint the prettiest picture they can. That said, you know, one never knows with Donald Trump, right? You know, I was going to say he thinks on his feet, but I think the more accurate phrase is he acts and speaks on impulse. And so I think depending on the questions or depending on what he saw on the television this morning that annoyed him, it's not clear that we're going to have a script that will be followed the way one would normally expect.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Edward Alden, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of a new book called Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Also with us, Emily Tamkin. She's staff writer for Foreign Policy. We have covered a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times, talking about Brexit, about the Mexican president canceling his trip to the United States. We've been talking a lot about populism, trade deals, trade wars. And you can join our conversation calling us at 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ted, let me go back to you, and speaking sort of broadly about trade wars, I mean, there are winners and losers, it seems, on trade wars, or trade deals, I should say, and I guess trade wars as well. But is there a way to rethink some of these trade deals to mitigate some of the hurt, some of the pain, some of the loss?
Well, I mean, look, the underlying rationale behind doing trade deals is that it benefits all parties. You know, countries specialize in what they're good at making, and they trade for things they're not so good at making, and the world is wealthier as a result. And when we've seen that play out over the last half century, you know, in the last couple of decades, we've seen more people worldwide brought out of poverty than any other comparable period in human history. And the growth of global trade is a big part of that. That said, there are people who get hurt by trade agreements. I think particularly if you look at segments of the manufacturing industry in the United States and in parts of Europe that have been subject to cheaper import competition, those people have been harmed. Some of that you can prevent through negotiating better terms in the trade arrangements. You know, I'm a believer, we don't want to get too far down in the weeds, but, yeah, you know, binding provisions to prevent currency manipulation or stronger labor and environmental standards, I think those are all good things. But a lot of the adjustment has to happen at home. You know, worker retraining programs, investments in infrastructure to create new jobs for people who lose theirs, you know, stronger education, investing in research and development, innovation to create new companies. So all of these things need to be done. The sort of let's close the door and put up tariffs and then we'll all be wealthy approach. The United States has tried that, tried it in the 1930s. Other countries tried it. It's a bad idea.
Emily, final question to you. Using your Russian expertise, what then do you anticipate looking ahead in the relationship between the U.S. and Russia, and specifically between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin?
I think there may be a bit of a honeymoon period, but plenty in Russia, both in society and in positions of some authority, do not actually expect the relationship between the United States and Russia to substantially improve. I tend to agree with them. There are rumors that that Trump will sign an executive order that would unilaterally lift sanctions on Russia. Would that improve relations in one sense? Sure. I think that in order for relations to improve, the United States would sort of need to take over Putin's Russia's mentality, and I don't see that happening. I don't really think that the Trump-Putin bromance is going to mean love between the two nations, no.
We're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you. I learned a lot. Emily Tamkin, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And she's staff writer for Foreign Policy. Edward Alden, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, it was great to be with you. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and, again, author of a new book called Failure to Adjust. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Download a podcast. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.